Welcome to On the Middle East, our Monitor's podcast on the big and interesting stories in the region. My name is Amran Zaman, and today I'll be chatting with Selim Koru, who is among the finest Turkey analysts of his generation. He has a fantastic Substack called Kulturkampf. I strongly advise you to subscribe to it. The topic at hand today is the nationwide municipal elections that are due to be held in Turkey on March 31st. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is determined to snatch back Istanbul from the main opposition Republican Party mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. So can he? And if so, what will this mean for the future of Turkey's battered democracy? And what role will the Kurds play in determining the outcome as they did the last time when they helped İmamoğlu win Istanbul? So welcome to our program. It's so great to have you again with us, Selim.
Oh, thanks, Amberin, for having me.
So we're going to be talking about the municipal elections that will be taking place at the end of this month. And much like you, I was not particularly enthusiastic about them, you know, after the, I wouldn't call it the shock exactly, because I think we all kind of predicted the outcome of the parliamentary and presidential elections in May, even though I briefly allowed myself to believe that the opposition would win. But yeah, so are people actually excited by this election in Turkey?
I don't think there's a lot of excitement, certainly not in the way that we saw last year, right? And you know, Erdogan has this phrase, beka, right? Beka seçimi, or the beka meselesi, meaning that, you know, he usually argues that elections are sort of existential, that people have to come out and vote. And this one doesn't feel that way, not anymore, because the Erdogan's greater political project is now looks much more secure, right? And this is more about, I would say, the pace of the opposition's decline. Like, are they going to decline very quickly? And is it going to be this very sharp drop after last year's elections? Or do they have more sort of staying power? Are they going to be able to determine their own structure a little bit and have more agency?
Wait, so are you suggesting that you pretty much are predicting a victory for the AKP in this election? And of course, the big prize is Istanbul.
Not for this election. I'm declaring victory for them, or they've declared victory for themselves, for sort of in politics altogether, right? And sort of the bigger picture, right? And then this election is about, like, to what extent they're going to be able to shape the opposition's structure going forward, right? And because so municipal elections are very important, I think, on the macro level, because municipalities are cash machines, right? You can generate lots of cash. You can generate lots of sort of elite buy-in if you have big municipalities, right? Or at least you can deny the other side some of that. So these big cities, especially, that they matter a great deal, right? And you can also, municipalities also allow you to sort of develop a new political generation. So young people who want to get into politics, they'll be more motivated to go through your party if you have, for example, a vital sort of structure in Istanbul, right? That where the intermediary jobs that you can have in the CHP, for example, in Istanbul, kind of matter right now, right? Or in Ankara, they matter. In a way that they wouldn't.
That's why these elections are actually quite critical, and especially for Erdogan, because he lost Istanbul the last time. terribly humiliating after that redo election. And so it's become almost a matter of honor for him, hasn't it? Yet, surprisingly, as you described so vividly in your Kulturkampf blog, he picked this really colorless, kind of weird candidate who's hopeless. I mean, certainly media-wise, he doesn't do much of a job, does he, presenting himself, as you pointed out. So if it's so critical, then why did he come up with such a lousy candidate?
I mean, that's intentional, right? That the candidate isn't really inspiring, that it's kind of a vacuum of charisma, really. He's got no sort of a political personality of his own. He's just a sort of conduit for Erdogan.
Murat Kurum, by the way.
Yeah, Murat Kurum is his name.
Yeah, and what does he do? What's his background again?
Well, he was sort of he was a bureaucrat, and he rose up in the AK Party structure, and then became minister for urban development and the environment, right? Yeah. Which is an important ministry in terms of sort of distributing rent and being able to, you know, shape things as they develop. But, you know, this isn't somebody who has big political clout of his own, right? And that's intentional, because Istanbul is a very special place for Erdogan, right? He was mayor of Istanbul for, you know, in the 90s. And the idea is always that that's his forever job. He maintains that job in a way, right? So the AK Party mayor of Istanbul is always kind of a conduit to Erdogan. Erdogan sort of acts through him. And people feel that very strongly, you know, that's really communicated to the voter. So the sort of 47% that Murat Kurum is polling at doesn't mean that, you know, people want Murat Kurum at that job. They want Erdogan at that job.
Well, it's fascinating in so many different ways, because on the one hand, as you say, it's about his background. That's where he rose to power as mayor of Istanbul in 1994, and then briefly went to jail, etc. So it's very dear to him. It's his city. But at the same time, the fact that, you know, he doesn't allow someone else to sort of grow out of that position suggests that perhaps our punditry about succession is in fact nonsensical, that this guy isn't even beginning to think about who comes after him, that he, you know, almost sees himself as immortal. And then, of course, there's the whole angle about him actually really seeing himself as some kind of sultan, the language that he started adopting that is kind of reflective of the way the sultans used to address their people. I mean, what do you think about all of that? What does this tell us about the psychology of Erdogan and the succession? I know I'm slightly veering off topic here, but we'll get back to the election.
No, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, he's got so much charisma, right? And it's so vast that, intentionally or not, he's just sucking up all the other political charisma from around him, right? And especially after last year's elections, he reshuffled the cabinet in a way that, you know, the few people like the former interior minister who had a sort of clout of their own were sidelined, and now it's all sort of these. It's like an American style cabinet more than the cabinets we used to have in the parliamentary system, where the idea was that members of a cabinet had their own political clout and their own political ideas, right? Whereas in the American system, it's more like, you know, that they belong to the executive branch. So it's a much more American cabinet in that sense. And yeah, I mean, he's a big figure, right? So I think people around him and certainly he himself see Erdogan as a world historical figure on the scale of sort of Napoleon, right? Or
well, I guess
Abraham Lincoln, you know, the kind of figure who sort of comes along once in a century or fewer, perhaps a longer time. and then rebuilds a nation, sort of separates it into its constituent parts and rebuilds it in a way that, for example, Lincoln is the sort of the first modern American president in a way, right? That or Napoleon sort of restructures what it means to be French, right? He sees himself as that kind of a leader, and
which is quite actually interesting, given that in my experience, he has very little knowledge of world history, by the way. But setting that aside and getting back to my original question about, you know, the risk he's obviously taking by fielding this chap, is also because the economy is in such dire straits. And, you know, if he's making this about him, and clearly he is when he, you know, throws away those remarks about this is my last election or whatever, you know, playing on the sort of the emotional sort of side of things. It's a risk, it's a gamble, isn't it? Because people typically in local elections in Turkey, however committed they are to A or B party, if they're not happy with the way the economy is going, they'll punish their own party. So again, I ask you, are you predicting a victory for Erdogan here? Because this is a referendum on him, because that's kind of how he set it up again.
Well, it could go either way. To get into some details here, what happened after last year was that the opposition fractured, right, into its various parties. But the sort of regime parties, or the YAK Party government's coalition, they remained together, right? And that's what you need, especially in regional elections, because you need a plurality in a regional election, right? Erdogan won the Istanbul mayoral race in 1994 by getting 25% of the vote, right? You need a plurality, and that was that at the time, right? So we're more polarized now, so that pluralities are larger, right? But what we have now is that the CHP is usually the biggest sort of opposition party, and the AK Party's candidate is usually in most of these cities the sort of the party of Erdogan. But what we have now is that there's smaller fractions of the opposition that are running their own candidate, right? So even if the opposition is more broader and more popular, the AK Party's candidate stands a pretty good chance of winning. Now, up until fairly recently, we thought, okay, the AK Party is fairly unified as well. But then there was a splinter from the AK Party as well, and that's Yeniden Refah, the son of Erdogan's mentor, Necmettin Erbakan. So Fatih Erbakan is younger. I believe he's his youngest son. Regrouped under his father's sort of banner, right, and is now opposing Erdogan in a lot of these cities.
And that's a risk, as you mentioned in your blog. I mean, obviously. So when you say that this could work to his advantage, the sort of fracturing, I wonder about that, because it seems like, as you mentioned yourself, the discontent can be channeled to Erbakan. Those voters who are, you know, would typically vote for Erdogan want to sort of punish him, perhaps, and they wouldn't feel like they're betraying the greater cause, Islamic Dawah, if they're going to another Islamist, right?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, we're now seeing lots of polling on this, and, you know, I'm pretty skeptical about reading polls these days.
It's yeah,
difficult to do. But, you know, some of the polls indicate that Refah, so the Islam splinter party, is getting quite a bit of traction, right? But in other places, what tends to happen is that towards the election, as we got closer to the election, the splinter parties get fewer and fewer votes, right? And things concentrate more in the big parties.
Is this right? True of municipal elections as well?
I suspect it will be. I suspect
and
it will be.
Even for Istanbul.
Because we can't really compare this to 2019, because we didn't have as many splinters in 2019. Things were pretty unified.
We're talking about the Kurds and how they determine the outcome of the election, especially in Istanbul. And they're fielding their own candidate this time. So how that plays out is actually quite unpredictable, isn't it? And turnout will be a key factor as well. But, I mean, sitting in London and not being there, obviously, it's a bit audacious on my part to make any kind of prediction. But, I mean, I get the distinct impression, we haven't started talking about him yet, and let's do that. İmamoğlu, the incumbent, the CHP mayor of Istanbul, seems to have developed his own persona, hasn't he? He almost stands above party politics and seems to have his own following that cuts across ideology and party lines. So in that sense, I mean, don't you think he has an advantage? He is the charismatic figure on the ground in Istanbul currently. However much Erdogan projects himself onto the city, he's also overseeing one of the worst economic crises in recent times in Turkey.
Yeah, so to give listeners a sense of this, so the CHP, Turkey's sort of oldest Republican party in the Kemalist party, has this Istanbul candidate who's fairly young. I believe he's 51 years old now. Enjoyed that landmark election victory in 2019. And yes, he is this national figure. He was sort of, a lot of people wanted him to run against Erdogan last year in the presidential election. And he couldn't for various sort of internal party political reasons within the CHP. And a lot of people still think that if he had run, he probably would have beaten Erdogan.
Do you think he would have?
That was a fairly decent chance. Yeah. It's certainly a higher chance than Kılıçdaroğlu. But so he's a pretty adept politician. He's very charismatic. He's very, like, when he walks down the street, he just sort of interacts with a lot of people. He's just one of those freaks of nature who's just very, very good at high intensity politics over a long period of time. Right. And he's polling at in the low 40s right now, and Murat Kurum is polling around 40. So there's not a lot of space there. But if you look at Istanbul in general, right, you see the AK Party candidate polling at around 40%, 42%. And if you want to stretch it, let's give him 45%. And the opposition is at 55%, right? So if the opposition had been able to unite, if they had all united behind İmamoğlu, right, they would have been able to have a much more comfortable election in Istanbul right now, because it does look like 55-45. So the cities are still trending in the opposition direction, right? The reason that the opposition isn't able to sort of win them is that opposition politics is fractured. And İmamoğlu, I think he's outperforming my expectations. I would have thought that the fractures, the smaller parties would have gotten bigger shares, especially like İYİ Parti, for example, would have gotten a bigger share. Zafer would have gotten a bigger share, right? And the CHP candidate, so İmamoğlu might have been in sort of 40 or high 30s, but that hasn't happened because of what you described, İmamoğlu's sort of personal charisma. But it's not clear to me that it'll be enough because of those splinter parties, because of that structural disadvantage that he has.
We'll have to see. I mean, as I said, it could go both ways because it depends on who they're sucking votes away from. And of course, voter turnout will be equally, I think, quite critical. And you know, the sort of dispassion that we've had for so long, if that persists among voters, how do you mobilize them? How, and to me, it seems that people will be more mobilized to punish rather than to reward in this election, which is why I suspect it is trickier than we think for Erdogan. I also find it quite fascinating how this Gaza thing hasn't necessarily played in his favor, and I'd be very interested to hear your views on this because, you know, on the one hand, he's out there condemning Israel using the incendiary language, etc., and then saying he supports Hamas. But then, as everybody keeps pointing out, the economic relations persist. And we've even seen reports based on open source data showing that his son owns ships that have been carrying goods to and from Israel. And it, apparently, I hear from my Arab contacts that, you know, Arab youths are very, of course, active in this whole boycott thing of boycotting Western goods, etc., trying to punish the US and others who support Israel. What they told me was that now people are boycotting Turkish goods that they see through the hypocrisy. So I'm wondering how, you know, people in Turkey who, you know, feel very strongly about Gaza, how they perceive things and what how that plays to Erbakan, you know, it plays into Erbakan's hands. Because again, he's been unequivocal, hasn't he? And sharply critical of the government's stance on Israel. Is that going to be a factor in this election?
I don't think it's going to be a significant factor, actually. I mean, Turkish voter behavior is very interesting. It defies a lot of, I think, sort of the persistent rational sort of ideas that people sometimes have. For example, people aren't very sensitive. The Erdogan voters, especially, or right-wing voters, or especially Islamist voters, aren't very sensitive to economic issues, right? We know this, especially after last year, that A, the AK Party is actually fairly good at ameliorating some of the economic damage that they do by sort of boosting employment and sort of their grassroots networks. They, you know, people are miserable, especially if they are on fixed income, but they still get the basic necessities, right? And they have this sort of, they have this implicit deal with Erdogan. And the idea is very much, I will deliver you important geopolitical gains, but you will suffer economically. And that's kind of okay. And that's, I think that's the sort of deal he has with his voters, and his voters really respond to that. So when you sort of go out and talk to people and who clearly are struggling economically, they still derive a great sense of pleasure from sort of having an indigenous arms industry and sort of having this big military and being engaged in this war with the PKK or the United
Oh
States or this
wow.
sort of
Are you
weirder
suggesting then
thing.
perhaps this huge operation that they claim they're going to be launching, and you have Ibrahim Kalın, Hakan Fidan, and the defense minister now in Iraq? Do you really think that that is linked to the election?
No, not at all. I think this is a long-term agreement between the voters and Erdogan, right?
Yeah, but you have to keep maintaining feeding that sort of facade of, you know, military power, of regional heft. And I mean,
Yeah,
where do you do that? What's the vehicle for that currently, if
but you
not?
do it on TV all the time. If like on, for example, the you know, if you tune into like TRT or Ahabat, these sort of big, well, one is the official state broadcaster. The other is sort of a very pro 24-hour AK Party news channel, where you do have this sort of continuously running script of, you know, greatness, a sort of imperial glory coming coming to your life at some point or other, right? But that script is always running. So you don't really need to time your geopolitics or your geopolitical calendar to local elections or something like that. I think voters understand that geopolitical events just occur on their own schedule, right? And the vote occurs on its own. And I think that's how sort of Erdogan's been able to build up to his current state, that he doesn't really have to do too many of these short-term things. Like, for example, on Israel, everybody knows, pretty much everybody in Turkey, all the voters know, that he is extremely sensitive on Israel, right? And people looking at this, I think all but the sort of pretty stringent Islamists looking at this will say, okay, if there is something to be done on Israel, Erdogan will do it, right? They have sort of that faith in him to sort of have that long-term perspective, right? So I don't think people care too much whether Turkey, you know, has an economic embargo on Israel or anything.
Okay, like so that. You're basically saying that, you know, his voters, his base has basically bought into what you describe as this deal where Turkey is restored to its former glory, even if it means people don't live quite as well as they used to when Erdogan was actually doing the right things, like democratic reforms and all the EU stuff. But I guess then my next question is, how do the Kurds fit into this election? Because, yeah, last time they were key. Are they still, or what's the state of play for them and their impact?
Well, the Kurds, so they've had to shut down their party and reform under what's now called Dem Party. Mm-hmm. And Dem Party is, of course, the biggest presence in the major Kurdish cities in the southeast. And there they will win the big elections, right? And the question is, will they be allowed to keep them? Because in 2019, as you also remember, Ambirin, they won all those cities, and then the government came in and took them away from them, basically. In a way that, you know, doesn't happen in the West, for example. If the CHP, you know, wins Izmir, which they usually do, right? The government doesn't just take it away from them. Or, you know, the CHP won in Istanbul. They sort of tried to take it away from them by rerunning the election, right? It's more difficult in the West. Whereas in the Southeast, the government, or the state rather, can use force to reach their political objectives, and nothing much happens. There isn't too much of a consequence for that, except, like, you know, some human rights reports in Brussels or something like that. And they don't really mind that. So it's probably what they're gonna do again. There was a sort of news package on TRT, the state broadcaster, that ran this week on how they did this in 2019, how they took over those cities and how great it turned out to be for everybody living in those cities. So which people interpreted as the state kind of priming voters in the Southeast to that outcome.
Right, for another takeover, you know, you can vote what you want, but we're going to be back and life is going to be great, kind of thing.
Yeah. That's
interesting. I mean, but again, let's go back to Istanbul and the Kurdish vote, which is quite significant, 11%. How does the fact that they're running their own candidate impact things? I mean, you think it's to the disadvantage. Well, it is to the disadvantage of the incumbent, because last time they all voted for him, and this time presumably they'll vote for their own. But does that automatically translate into a victory for Erdogan. I mean, what's the state of play? What do you think if Erdogan and the Dem Party leadership had to sit down? What would they be discussing? What's there to negotiate, if anything? Or
So
does
they
Erdogan not
sit
care at this
down.
point? The fact of them not supporting İmamoğlu is kind of good enough.
So on the Kurds, Dem Party in Istanbul, there were several possible outcomes this election cycle. So since the opposition was split, Dem Party couldn't be under the main opposition umbrella. They kind of had to declare their candidate. And their choice was, were they going to go with a strong candidate or a weak candidate? Right. And some people said if they end up going with a strong candidate, it means that they've made a deal with the other party. And the deal that everybody thought about was okay, because Selahattin Demirtas, the former leader of the HDP, and probably like the most skilled and successful politician in Turkey's recent history after. Perhaps after Erdogan, I'd say, or also İmamoğlu is also very skilled, but Demirtaş really sort of brought the HDP and the Kurdish movement out of its shell and was able to develop it, and that's basically why he's in jail. And people thought, okay, the HDP might make a deal with Erdogan to get him out of jail, right? Because he's essentially a political prisoner. So people thought the deal might be that the HDP runs a strong candidate, gets Demirtas out, and sort of gets the CHP to lose in Istanbul. It would have been conceivable they could have done that, but they didn't. But they couldn't just run no candidate, I think, because of the political environment we were in after the
So the
election.
weak candidate is meant to benefit the opposition.
So the weak candidate, I think,
Because there'll be lower turnout and possibly even some of their constituents voting for İmamoğlu because they kind of like him.
exactly. As you mentioned, the HDP or Dem Party now gets 10 plus percent in Istanbul, generally, or probably more. And the Dem Party candidate, I think, right now is polling at around like 4%, plus or minus two.
That's pretty pathetic. Oh, wow.
Well,
I
it's
didn't know
by
that.
design, right? That's by design because Dem Party doesn't want the CHP to lose, but they can also not run a candidate, so they have to
No,
run
so
some kind of candidate,
it's
but they're running a weak candidate. But the
So
thing is,
if they withdraw their candidate at the last minute, who does that benefit?
well, the
If
person will still be on the ballot,
right. It's too
right?
late,
So,
right? It's too
yeah,
late.
it's too late.
Okay, so I'm trying, my conspiratorial mind is at work here. I mean, all this talk about an operation in Iraq and, going after the PKK and the leadership, because they're talking about this area called Gare, where Murat Karayılan, one of the top two PKK commanders, is based. I mean, do you To me, it almost seems like psychological pressure more than anything else. And, we can talk about the whole Iraq thing, PKK thing during a separate program, but it seems to me that this is some kind of stick that the government is wielding at them. And so if that's the case, what is it that they want from them? What would they want them to do to help them win the election in Istanbul? Or
Well,
is it just too late in the game and I'm just being silly and conspiratorial?
no, I mean, the strong candidate would have been Selahattin Demirtas's wife, right?
Right. So she's not running.
Because she's not, I mean, if she had ran, she would have gotten somewhere around 10%.
Right,
She would have
right.
gotten close to 10%. And then it would have been impossible
Okay, so are you
for
saying it's
İmamoğlu to
too
run.
late for this kind of stuff, and the whole Iraq PKK thing has nothing to do with the election?
Yeah, I don't think. I mean, the Dem Party electorate is pretty disciplined. It's probably the most disciplined electoral force in Turkey. But even them, they wouldn't be able to sort of swing their voters for or against the government or the AK Party candidate in 2 weeks or 10
Well,
days.
there is somebody who could, Abdullah Öcalan.
Even him, I don't know.
Really?
Maybe like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but
well, it hasn't been
days.
Tested for a long time, so we don't actually know. And we're running out of time. I mean, usually my program lasts for 20 minutes. I've already doubled that because I can't get enough of you, Selim. But final question. We've been kind of all over the place, but that's my fault. But I still think it's been fascinating here listening to you.
Yeah, been enjoying it. Thank you.
Yeah, so Erdogan wins, meaning he gets Istanbul back and does well generally. What does that mean? Because a lot of people are saying that's like the final nail in the coffin of whatever's left of Turkish democracy, and it'll be full regime consolidation. Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah, as I said, it's, I think to me, what I see in this election is the pace of disintegration within the opposition, right? That's what's at stake. Will it disintegrate fast and then be reconstituted in the mold of the new regime, or will it disintegrate perhaps slower and retain some of its structure, right? And unexpected things could also happen. So if İmamoğlu loses Istanbul, for example, the most likely thing that he would do next would be to try to get the CHP's leadership. And he would challenge.
Be much harder, though, for a losing candidate to do that.
It would, yeah. It would be harder for him after losing Istanbul, and B, the CHP is very complicated party. I mean, it's probably easier to win the Istanbul election.
Well, we're hearing that
than to...
Kılıçdaroğlu now has his little office in Ankara, where he's sort of quietly plotting some kind of comeback, or just, I don't know.
Yeah.
It all sounds quite awful.
Yeah.
But your take is basically pessimistic, because you're just saying it's a matter of how fast or slowly the opposition disintegrates, but it will anyway. I kind of disagree with that. I think that if İmamoğlu wins, that will give him and the opposition fresh momentum. He will have beaten Erdogan a third time.
Well, listen, Erdogan has been, well, he's been really running Turkey for arguably a quarter century, right? And his game is to reframe the entire regime of the country. Redo the constitution, redo the entire sort of mythology and the way the country thinks of itself. Very sort of deep reconstruction of the country. And then have a big geopolitical sort of imperial presence, right? That's the broader Erdogan project. And I mean, I mentioned that his following and the people around him, they see him as a world historical figure, and certainly a sort of a person who reframes the entire country, right? So that in his mind, in the future in Turkey, there will be elections, right? But they'll, like, both sides of the aisle will be pro Erdogan sides, right? The way that they were with Atatürk, for example, right? You know, in Turkish elections, Atatürk wasn't really on the ballot. It was more the sense that he was the founding father of the country. Both sides were Kemalist, right? But they were, you know, one was more right wing, one was more left wing, right? So the way they want to structure it is that both sides will be Erdoganist. It's just slightly different flavors, right? That's what they want for the future.
Like Putin's Russia, really.
Exactly. Yeah.
A
yeah.
Loyal
that's...
opposition. It's like a total, like full. Russia. But I mean, on the one hand, the paradox to me, as somebody who's been covering Turkey for far too long, is how little it's changed. And we've discussed this, you and I, before. And so it almost seems like a different veneer for the same old kind of project. And it's to sustain that you need to keep reinventing the cover. It ultimately boils down to a very tightly controlled, maybe not the economy, but the state. The red lines are enduring and persistent.
I think you're right in the sense that, yes, very little has changed, right? The state is still the state, and the state is still this big, oppressive, awful presence hanging over everything, right? And I don't think it was these serious political actors' intentions to change that. It wasn't to make it more benevolent, more European.
We believed that that was Erdogan.
Yeah, for a hot second in like the 2000s. But I think right now that the project is to develop that in a new, more geopolitical orientation, right? Because Erdogan's critique of the state wasn't really that that the state was too powerful and domineering. His critique was that the state wasn't powerful enough, right? That it wasn't sort of outwardly enough. That Turkey was punching below its weight, way below its weight geopolitically. And he wanted to invert something within the country to sort of direct that sort of political energy outwards again, right?
Well, he succeeded. I would say that he succeeded on that score. I mean, Turkey is definitely a big player regionally, more than it's ever been, more independent. Yeah. But that you could say that about other countries in the region too. And at what cost? At what cost to its citizens? And that's something that its citizens will need to figure out, and we'll see what they decide on March 31st. Selim, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
And this brings us to the end of this episode of On the Middle East. I always enjoy my conversations with Selim, and I do hope you did too. Thank you and goodbye.